A new FX drama series, American Horror Story, premiered last week, and last night's AMC's Breaking Bad presented its season finale. Our TV critic, David Bianculli, is eager to talk about both of them.
If you don't want to hear details, especially about last night's season finale of Breaking Bad, turn down your radio volume for a few minutes. But I consider it fair game to talk in detail about TV shows once they've been televised, especially if they're doing interesting enough work to be saluted for it. I was blown away by the season ender of Breaking Bad. For its season finale, it set up a high-stakes showdown, with the cold-blooded drug kingpin Gus on one side, and the newly reconciled Walter White and Jesse Pinkman, former partners in Gus's high-tech meth lab, on the other. Each side wanted the other dead, but both sides were on guard. In last week's episode, Jesse successfully lured Gus to a local hospital, and Walter's plan was to plant and ignite a bomb under Gus's car. But Gus intuitively left the car in the parking lot and found another ride home. That left Walter in the opening minute of the season finale to dismantle the bomb in frustration and bring it into the hospital, hidden in a knapsack. He sits next to Jesse, who's sitting in the hallway outside a pediatric intensive care ward, and the two exchange words. Bryan Cranston plays Walter, Aaron Paul plays Jesse. And why I love this scene so much is because it's such an amazing high-wire act. It's absurdly funny and intensely dramatic all at the same time. In short, it's why I adore Breaking Bad.
What did you say to Gus? Because he's on to us. Yeah.
I didn't say Jack. What do you mean he's on
to
us?
He's walking to his car, then suddenly he isn't. What, does he have some kind of sixth sense? Jesus, what did you say to him?
Could I ask my own question right now, at this point? Did you just bring a bomb into a hospital?
What? Was I supposed to leave it on his car?
What, you're supposed to bring into a hospital? Oh, my God.
Where can we find Gus? Name a place, name me one place where I could surprise him, where he won't see me coming. Because his house, the laundry, the restaurant, the factory farm, they are all wired with cameras. One place. Think. Jesse, think. Where is it? Where? Because if you can't tell me, we are dead.
For the rest of the finale, there were scenes that made me laugh and scenes that made me drop my jaw. In order, those would be Bob Odenkirk's scenes as lawyer Saul Goodman and the final showdown with Gus. And, as always with this series, there was a final image that will linger with me until new episodes arrive again. This time, the camera slowly closed in on a flower pot in Walter's backyard, eventually identifying it as a variety of poisonous plant, which in turn identified Walter as the true perpetrator of the crime he had accused Gus of doing. In true Machiavellian fashion, Walter had framed Gus and risked killing a young kid, all to get Jesse back on his side and against Gus. Series creator Vince Gilligan said from the start he wanted to take Walter White and viewers on a journey, following the central character as he changes from meek hero to forceful villain. In this fourth season finale, Breaking Bad delivered on that promise brilliantly. By the end of this season, Walter isn't just Breaking Bad, he's broken. With American Horror Story, it's harder to believe the show's creators have a 5-year plan. But at least, after having seen the first 3 episodes, I can promise there's a short-term one. Series creators Ryan Murphy and Brad Falchuk, who worked together on Glee and Nip Tuck, have a history of letting their shows go all over the place. American Horror Story starts all over the place, then slowly reveals the logic and history of it all. The central story has Connie Britton from Friday Night Lights and Dylan McDermott from The Practice as a couple whose marriage is in trouble. She's just had a miscarriage, he's just had an affair. And they move to the West Coast with their teen daughter in tow to see if a new environment can spark a new start. Except they can't pass up an unbelievably tempting real estate deal and move into a house whose previous tenants were found dead. The house comes with its own housekeeper, played by Frances Conroy from 6 Feet Under, and creepy neighbor, played by Jessica Lange. Last week's premiere was a polarizing jumble of images, characters, scares, and subplots. Some people hated it, but I really, really liked it. And knowing what's to come in the next 2 weeks only has me liking it more. It helps to know, for example, the prologue that opened the pilot episode, showing the house at a different point in its history, is a recurring theme each week, like the flashback device on Lost. And it may encourage reluctant viewers to give the show another chance if they know that even by episode 3, a few mysteries indeed will be solved. Like, for example, why the elderly housekeeper has one dead eye. And in addition to secrets, there also are scares. As when, in this week's episode, Connie Britton's Vivian has a late-night visitor at the door while her husband is out of town. Vivian may sound paranoid, peering through the peephole and reacting to the female voice on the other side of the door, but she has every right to be.
Who's dead? Who is it?
Excuse me, ma'am. I don't want to bother you, but I'm hurt and needing some help.
What happened to you?
I'm hurt and needing some help. Open the door.
You said that. Can you tell me what happened? How did you get hurt?
Can't you see the blood on my face? He's out here. Let me in. What kind of woman are you? He's coming. He's gonna stab me.
I'm gonna get help. I'm calling 911.
These two shows, Breaking Bad and American Horror Story, are by no means at the same level. Breaking Bad, along with AMC's Mad Men, ranks as the best drama on TV right now. American Horror Story, like many of its characters, starts off as more of an intriguing oddity. But both shows have me thinking about them long after I've turned off the TV set, which for me is the mark of must-see TV.
David Bianculli is founder and editor of TVWorthWatching.com and teaches TV and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. Roberta Sharuk directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
With us to listen in on how Spanish has been used on television is NPR's Felix Contreras, producer for NPR's Arts Desk. And Felix, when did U.S. audiences start to hear Spanish on the airwaves?
You know, pretty much since the earliest days of the medium. And the most prominent example of this is the show that set viewing records in the 1950s and also featured a character with a thick accent who struggled with English.
Mira que me ha hecho, no sé lo que me hace. ¿Qué cosa quiere, mujer?
Ay, ay, ay. That was, of course, Desi Arnaz as band leader Ricky Ricardo on the I Love Lucy show. And he was married to Lucille Ball and was the mastermind behind this show. But what I think a lot of people don't really understand is that I think he was shrewdly using his otherness and controlling just how far the laughs would go. Now, in this next clip, some friends from Cuba are visiting the Ricardos in New York, and they don't speak English. Lucy has been doing things like speaking loudly and all the things that people do when they talk to people who don't speak English. And then they toast with glasses of wine, which calls for more Spanish.
Un poquito de vino, María.
Gracias.
Lucy? Carlos, ¿quieres un poquito de vino?
Sí, muchas gracias. Bueno, a sus saludes.
A la salud.
A Cubita Bella.
L'chaim.
I think that clip was an example of the vision of that show, because ultimately the laugh line is delivered in Yiddish as a way of saying Yiddish, Spanish, English. We're all Americans, no matter what language we speak at home.
Language was also, of course, used to stereotype at times.
I think there were far more examples of that than enlightened uses over the years. Now, check out this clip from a Looney Tunes Speedy Gonzales cartoon, which I used to watch on Saturday mornings.
El gringo pussycat probablemente.
Probablemente grosso. Gonzales asiste ancho, camarados.
Sí, Gonzales apalada asiste ancho, camarados.
Obviously, the Spanish dialogue was just gibberish, and the storylines, the exaggerated accents, all very, very stereotypical.
Was there ever a point in TV history when speaking Spanish was part of a natural flow of an English language TV show?
You know, I've never seen a completely bilingual show on English language TV, but the closest I've seen on how many Latinos mix English and Spanish in conversation was on the sitcom The George Lopez Show, which ended a few years ago. In this next clip, George is on a visit for a potential job, and he finds out he was recruited only as a token Latino manager.
Well, yeah, we had a Rodriguez, but he could pass for Italian. You, look at you. You are a dark brown Mexican hermano. Oh, yeah? Well, you can watch these dark brown Mexican nalgas walking away from you.
And then the word in that got the laugh?
The word was nalgas, which is kind of a crude slang for saying rear end. Now, it's funny to me because it's something I'd heard a million times, but I never expected to hear it on network television. George Lopez's show was an example of not laughing at the Spanish and the culture, but laughing with it.
Well, let's go back full circle to Ricky Ricardo by way of another character with an accent from the current hit show on ABC, Modern Family.
That would be the Colombian-American trophy wife, Gloria, played by Sofia Vergara, who was handing out a comedy award last month at the Emmys with Rob Lowe.
The category of outstanding lead actress in a comedy has been home to many legends, from Mary Tyler Moore to Lucille Ball, who this year would have been 100 years old.
Ay, I love Lucy. Yeah. But you know what? I never really understood her, what she was saying. Her accent was thick, no?
You know, anyone who speaks Spanish who's heard that clip, they laugh out loud at the idea of Lucy having an accent. And Sofia Vergara plays her character Gloria on that show Modern Family in a lot of ways like a combination of Ricky and Lucy being in control of how and when the language gets a laugh, which kind of brings us full circle and gives us an idea of just how ahead of his time Ricky Ricardo was.
NPR's Felix Contreras is a reporter-producer for NPR's Arts Desk, and he's also co-host of Alt Latino, an online show about Latin alternative music. Felix, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
With us to listen in on how Spanish has been used on television is NPR's Felix Contreras, producer for NPR's Arts Desk. And Felix, when did U.S. audiences start to hear Spanish on the airwaves?
You know, pretty much since the earliest days of the medium. And the most prominent example of this is the show that set viewing records in the 1950s and also featured a character with a thick accent who struggled with English.
Mira que me ha hecho, no sé lo que me hace.
That was, of course, Desi Arnaz as band leader Ricky Ricardo on the I Love Lucy show. And he was married to Lucille Ball and was the mastermind behind this show. But what I think a lot of people don't really understand is that I think he was shrewdly using his otherness and controlling just how far the laughs would go. Now, in this next clip, some friends from Cuba are visiting the Ricardos in New York, and they don't speak English. Lucy has been doing things like speaking loudly and all the things that people do when they talk to people who don't speak English. And then they toast with glasses of wine, which calls for more Spanish.
Un poquito de vino, María.
Gracias.
Lucy? Carlos, ¿quieres un poquito de vino?
Sí, muchas gracias. Bueno, a sus saludes.
A la salud.
A cubita bella.
Ojaim.
You know, I think that clip was an example of the vision of that show, because ultimately the laugh line is delivered in Yiddish as a way of saying Yiddish, Spanish, English. We're all Americans no matter what language we speak at home.
Language was also, of course, used to stereotype at times.
I think there were far more examples of that than enlightened uses over the years. Now, check out this clip from a Looney Tunes Speedy Gonzalez cartoon, which I used to watch on Saturday mornings.
El gringo pussycat probablemente.
Probablemente grosso. González existe ancho, comrados.
Sí, sí, González apolada existe ancho, comrados.
Obviously, the Spanish dialogue was just gibberish, and the storylines, the exaggerated accents, all very, very stereotypical.
Was there ever a point in TV history when speaking Spanish was part of a natural flow of an English language TV show?
You know, I've never seen a completely bilingual show on English language TV, but the closest I've seen on how many Latinos mix English and Spanish in conversation was on the sitcom The George Lopez Show, which ended a few years ago. In this next clip, George is on a visit for a potential job, and he finds out he was recruited only as a token Latino manager.
Yeah, we had a Rodriguez, but he could pass for Italian. You, look at you. You are a dark brown Mexican hermano. Oh, yeah? Well, you can watch these dark brown Mexican nalgas walking away from you.
And then the word in that got the laugh?
The word was nalgas, which is kind of a crude slang for saying rear end. Now, it's funny to me because it's something I'd heard a million times, but I never expected to hear it on network television. George Lopez's show was an example of not laughing at the Spanish and the culture, but laughing with it.
Well, let's go back full circle to Ricky Ricardo by way of another character with an accent from the current hit show on ABC, Modern Family.
That would be the Colombian-American trophy wife, Gloria, played by Sofia Vergara, who was handing out a comedy award last month at the Emmys with Rob Lowe.
The category of outstanding lead actress in a comedy has been home to many legends, from Mary Tyler Moore to Lucille Ball, who this year would have been 100 years old.
Ay, I love Lucy. Yeah. But you know what? I never really understood her, what she was saying. Her accent was thick, no?
You know, anyone who speaks Spanish who's heard that clip, they laugh out loud at the idea of Lucy having an accent. And Sofia Vergara plays her character Gloria on that show Modern Family in a lot of ways like a combination of Ricky and Lucy being in control of how and when the language gets a laugh, which kind of brings us full circle and gives us an idea of just how ahead of his time Ricky Ricardo was.
NPR's Felix Contreras is a reporter-producer for NPR's Arts Desk, and he's also co-host of Alt Latino, an online show about Latin alternative music. Felix, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
On CBS's hit TV show, The Good Wife, Alan Cumming plays Eli Gold, a pithy, spiffy political consultant turned crisis manager in a law firm in Chicago.
The first rule of managing a crisis, the top man answers the questions. That is the only reason you are here. That is the only reason I am talking to you. So in 10 minutes' time, you're giving a press conference where you'll order all your cheese products off the shelves. We need a split screen of that image with you looking strong. Wrong tie. Get him a red tie. Then you'll apologize for any missteps and say the buck stops here.
Off of that set, Alan Cumming is a writer, director, cabaret singer, and the host of one of public television's signature series where we get to hear his real voice.
I'm Alan Cumming, and this is Masterpiece Mystery.
If you'd like to talk with Alan Cumming, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. And Alan Cumming is with us now from our bureau in New York. Nice to have you with us on the program today.
Thanks, Neil. Nice to talk to you.
And you have a red tie on.
I'm completely naked, actually.
That's charming. When do you get to play the real classic Scottish parts, you know, like Macbeth or James Bond?
Well, funnily enough, I'm going to play Macbeth next summer in the gap between The Good Wife, in the summer holidays from The Good Wife, with the National Theatre of Scotland. So it doesn't get much more Scottish.
No, it doesn't. Any bites on James Bond, though?
I think Daniel Craig's safe in his job for now.
Okay. I wanted to ask you, your part was introduced as in the first season of The Good Wife as a campaign manager and not intended to last very long.
No, I came on to do... Well, I mean, they said one, maybe a couple more episodes, and then he just kind of stayed. He just sort of fitted, I suppose.
Well, he took off because, it's a good part, it's well written, and you're playing it very, very well.
Thank you very much. I really enjoy it. I mean, it's a very, it's funny, like sometimes when, you know, you play someone who's very, very different to yourself, and in a world that you don't really know initially or understand, it's sort of daunting. But actually, I thought of Eli just as I've thought of the many other characters I've played that I don't know anything about, but they tend mostly to be superheroes or animals or, you know, kind of mythical characters. So I've put him in that same gallery.
He is, the character part is loosely based on Rahm Emanuel, of course, yeah. Served as chief of staff to the President Obama and now the mayor of Chicago. Do you watch him for tips?
I did a little bit at the beginning, but then, you know, you have to let that go. I just was interested about, I did a little bit of research on him and, you know, the sort of coiled spring nature of him I find quite helpful. And just, it was more about reading about him and seeing the, you know, the public face and then imagining what the private one was like.
The ability to explode in yeah. private and then turn around and present the calm face to the client.
And yes, exactly. And also the fact that, you know, when he loses it, it's about, it's passion. It's not about, it's not a mean, well, it is kind of mean, but it's about this absolute inexorable need to just vent about the fact that he hasn't been able to do his job properly. I was also really fascinated by, I mean, Eli has this past where he was a concert pianist that hasn't really been developed yet, but I was
wondering about more backstory because we don't know what he does when he goes home.
Yes, not very much, I imagine. We're starting to find a little bit more this season that we're shooting now, but the piano thing is, there's like a metronome in my office and there's a little basket of piano keys, like a sort of little tchotchke, and I think that's interesting because I didn't know until I started this that Rahm Emanuel was a former ballet dancer.
I did not know that either.
Who knew? I know.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's a really fascinating kind of bizarre twist to the story. But in this season coming up, we find out, like, I'm last season I had a daughter, a teenage daughter. Now I have an ex-wife, and that's been played by Parker Posey. So we've had some really great stuff to do.
And a good cast to work with, too.
Oh, yeah. Oh, they're really, it's such good actors. And, you know, it's lovely. There's great regular people who are just really nice people as well as being really great to work with. But then you get these amazing actors coming in for the guest star roles. It's amazing, actually. Each week when I see the new cast list, I'm really excited about who they are. And Parker, I've known for years and done a few films with, and we're having a real laugh playing former lovers.
There is also a lot of music in your background, too.
Yes, I've been known to use my pipes.
You have a cabaret show that you perform from time to time.
Yeah, I do. A couple of years ago, I started. I'd always kind of been scared of singing as myself. But I actually, when I did do it, and the rare occasions I did do it, I really liked the way that you connect with an audience and that it's sort of, there's not really the same veil of a character between you. You really just are you. And I'm really fascinated about just breaking down the layers of artifice between an audience and an artist. So I finally did this cabaret show. I called it I Bought a Blue Car Today because it was sort of about me becoming an American citizen, and that was the sentence I had to write down to prove I could read English in my test. And it was a really amazing thing for me to do a show like that was that, you know, exposing, and I really liked it, and I've kind of kept doing it.
Craig Ferguson wrote a book about his decision to move to this country and become an American citizen. And I don't know if you know him or if you're familiar with it.
I haven't read Craig's book, but I know Craig from like decades ago in Glasgow. We were once in a show together in the theatre in Glasgow. It's when he used to do a character called Bing Hitler.
Yes, I've read about Bing Hitler.
He was hilarious. So, yeah, I know Craig from old times.
Why did you decide to become an American citizen? You can cross the ocean and keep working.
Yes, when I'd had a green card and I got another green card. So I really the good thing about a green card is you can do everything that a proper American can do except vote. And I wanted to vote in the last election for Barack Obama, and I failed because the immigration process is slightly slower than it was, you know, 10 years ago, understandably. And so I didn't get to be. And actually, I think I realised that once you become a citizen, you're not allowed to vote immediately. There's like a time lapse that you have to wait before you're allowed to vote. So I voted in the midterm elections, and I'm going to vote for Barack Obama again in next year.
We're talking with actor Alan Cumming, one of the emerging stars on The Good Wife. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we get a caller in on the conversation. This is Diane. Diane with us from Napa in California.
Hi. I just want to say that I've been an avid watcher of The Good Wife, and I just think you're phenomenal. Phenomenal. And I'm sorry that I haven't, I don't know what I've seen you in prior to, but where, and now I'm hearing that you're from Scotland. Where did you get your start? I mean, where is it all from?
Began in a stable.
In a stable in Bethlehem?
No, Coonisty. I went to drama school in Scotland and I started working in theatre there, and then I moved to London and then I started to do films. You know, blah blah. It's kind of.
Well, you said a moment ago what you singing for yourself. Your big breakthrough, at least as far as this country goes, was in cabaret singing as the MC.
Yes, I sort of think there's various moments in my life that changed things, and I played the MC in cabaret on Broadway about 12 years ago, and that was a big deal.
And nobody could imagine anybody but Joel Grey in the part until you came along.
You know, it's so weird that you say that. I had a dream about Joel Grey last night. Isn't that funny?
Yeah. What did he do?
He had this funny wig on. We're just chatting. But anyway, I don't normally dream about Joel, but I just did last night. Isn't that weird?
It is strange. All right. Diane, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think she had something nice to say, and
yes.
I hung up on her by mistake.
See,
I apologize
sure
for
is.
That. Yeah. Yeah. Stephen's on the line, calling from Chaska in Minnesota.
Hi, Alan.
Hello.
It's very nice to talk to you. I had a question about accents. You and Hugh Laurie are so American-sounding in your roles. How do you prepare for that?
Well, you know, you have to, I mean, I think you have to have a good ear. Definitely. But I think American people forget how bombarded the rest of the world is by American culture. And so, you know, we hear an American accent so much more than you hear other outside of America accents. So it's not as hard as it seems, I think. And if you have a good ear, like a musical ear, then you pick up on different sounds and things like that. And obviously some are harder than others. Like I actually made a film in Minnesota called Sweetland about 5 years ago. And I had to play a Minnesotan farmer. That was a bit of a challenge.
I lived in London for a while, and you used to see, this was some years ago, but some English actors had what I called the I-80 accent that would wander from coast to coast and several stops in between. It was just sort of generically American, but aspects of the Bronx and then right to Indiana.
That's right, exactly. I know those ones. But I think actually, you know, if it's something to do with being Scottish as well. I think we are... definitely at drama school I was told and trained that I had to be able to lose my accent. Otherwise, you know, there aren't many jobs just for people talking like this. So I think from early on I was used to having to do lots of different accents and being more attentive towards it. But I do know, I mean, it's not everyone can do a good American accent. I know that. But I think if you were as bombarded by a British culture as we are by American culture, you would be better at it than... I imagine you are right now.
And that only happens when we watch PBS. Stephen, thanks very much for the phone call. Let's see if we get one more caller in quickly. Felicia from St. Louis, we just have a few seconds.
Yes, I just want to tell Mr. Cummings, I loved his character in The Anniversary, which is a wonderful movie, and it was a very complex character, and I just wanted to know his thoughts about that.
Oh, well, thank you. I really, that's The Anniversary Party. I wrote that and directed that.
I didn't even realize it. That was a
great movie. Oh, yes. Me, Jennifer Jason Leigh and I, you know.
And gave himself a wonderful part.
Yeah. I wrote myself. And we wrote Jennifer a wonderful part. We wrote and directed and produced that. So I really like that film too. And I think it's interesting. It had, you know, had a lot to say about a relationship, an adult relationship, and a lot to say about Los Angeles. And it was just something that was a real, something that Jennifer and I just, you know, something we thought we managed to get it made. It all went down well and people really connect to it in the way that we like. So that's one of my favorite things I've done, actually.
Yeah, mine too.
Well, thanks very much. And finally, based on Rahm Emanuel, is Eli Gold going to run for mayor?
I don't know. I think Eli's slightly more obsessed with Peter Florek's political ambitions so far. But, you know, who knows? That's the great thing about being on a TV show that doesn't have an ending. You never know what's going to happen. I used to really hate that about being on the show, but now I've really embraced it and I like it.
Alan Cumming, thanks very much for your time. Good luck on The Good Wife.
Thank you.
Alan Cumming plays Eli Gold. He joins us today from our bureau in New York. Tomorrow, of course, Wednesday. That means politics. We'll rate the Republicans' performances on the New Hampshire debate stage. Join us for that. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.